Picture June 1945, San Francisco. Delegates from 50 countries are about to sign the United Nations Charter. This is the document of the UN. Meanwhile, World War II is still going on. Much of the world is in ruins. And here, in San Francisco, everyone is looking to the future, to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war. That's a phrase straight from the preamble of the UN Charter. To strengthen international law, to promote better standards of living, and to reaffirm faith in fundamental human rights, in the dignity and worth of the human person, in the equal rights of men and women, and of nations large and small. And that last line brings us to our topic today, human rights as equal rights of men and women. Welcome to UN Gender Focus, a podcast from the United Nations in New York. I'm Paulina Greer. Out of the 850 delegates who signed the UN Charter, four were women, among them Bertha Lutz from Brazil and Minerva Bernardino from the Dominican Republic. And out of the 50 countries represented, women only had voting rights in 30 of them. So who were these women and those who joined them in the coming years to create the UN as we know it today? And just as importantly, why are we just learning about women at the origins of the UN? Does history have a double standard? I spoke to three women researchers who were at the UN headquarters recently to help answer these questions.
I'm Fatima Satour. I'm a research associate at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. And with Elise Dietrichson, we've been working on the origins of gender equality in the UN Charter. I've been focusing more specifically on how to advocate for the recognition of the women who got gender equality in the UN Charter.
I'm Elise Dietrichson, and I got to know Fatima Satour when we studied together at School of Oriental and African Studies, SOAS. So we are both research associates there now. I've been looking specifically into the minutes, so what was said and what was written at the time that the UN was established, to find how was language on women and gender equality included into the UN.
My name is Rebecca Adami, so I'm a senior lecturer at Stockholm University in Sweden. And I've done research on the Charter and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. I've been writing a book called Women and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And there I'm also building on memoirs and biographies from several of these historical women, two who were part of the San Francisco Conference, and then also two women who were part of drafting the Declaration of Human Rights.
I want to ask each one of you a little bit more about what you're doing. But before we get into the details, it's 2018. It's been 70 years. Why are we only talking about this issue now?
Well, it can be a bit frustrating. When Elise and I found out about this 2 years ago, I guess I was a bit naive because I thought that, oh, someone is going to say, oh, wait, we already lost 70 years of this history. Now we have to promote it. Unfortunately, that's not how things really go, and things take a bit of time. So yes, we are a bit late, but here it is. And I hope that now, inside the UN, but also academia and diplomats' missions will really take ownership of the story and keep promoting and recognizing the women who founded the UN.
I mean, Elise and Fatima done a really, really powerful advocacy work, I feel, within the UN to really try to lift women's voices in the history. When I started with my postdoc project on women and the declaration and found these female names in the UN records, I was surprised that other researchers had not been actually focusing on these women. Mm. And I think maybe one of the reasons is that earlier researchers have been male and Western, and they've also lifted some of the male and Western delegates and their contribution to these documents. I think that researchers and people outside of research, we get interested in narratives and stories that we can relate to. And maybe that is one of the reasons why it's taken a lot of time before these women are being acknowledged. Because now, like Fatima from Algeria, Elise from Norway, me with different backgrounds. We've been really inspired by these women, and maybe also like we relate and find this really fascinating. It takes a lot of time to both do research and advocate for these issues, so you need a lot of passion and a lot of willpower, because I think that we, all three of us, have experienced that not everyone share the passion for this particular narrative.
So catching just what you said not a lot of people share the passion. How have you found that your research has been, you know, has it been welcomed? Have diplomats been super excited about it? What have the reactions been?
It's fascinating because Fatima and I, we were here at the UN 2 years ago and we had a press conference, but it was a room filled with, I don't know, 5 or 6 journalists. And luckily enough, we had a story written by Associated Press, so it did have some outreach. But it's not the first time we've been telling this story. We were in Geneva at the UN 2 years ago, and there were interest, but after telling these, what we believe to be very fascinating, important contributions to the UN from its founding, things haven't really happened immediately. Like Fatima started saying, like, oh, you would expect, you know, the different delegations to really take ownership of these different women, you know, the Uruguayan, the Colombian, the Brazilian, to immediately take this story as their own and see this as also important today, as how they want to be seen as, you know, diplomats in the UN and being very proud of this history. But it takes so much time. And like Rebecca said, like, you keep on having to promote the same story again and again. But I think what we see now is we are, you know, we receive very, very positive kind of recognition for what we say. We had a very great event yesterday with, I think it was 200 people attending. And that's quite unique in a UN setting. And it was, and you had women ambassadors talking in ways they haven't been talking before, and male ambassadors promoting their own women. Like, really, there was some ownership, finally, I think, to the history.
To jump on one point, I think there has been research, one research at least about it before, 8 years ago, by Toril Skart, who's a Norwegian academic. And she was writing about very similar findings at the end. The difference is that there was no advocacy after that. So as academics and as researchers, a lot of people just publish their paper and that's it. And then they wait, I don't know, for someone to pick it up. What we've been doing is really doing research and then really pushing for it. And even with that, because you need time, you need willingness, and a lot of researchers just go on and research on about other things. And even with that, you really need a lot of persistence and passion, again, to keep promoting that until at some point, someone realized that this is huge and this is a treasure and that it should reach a wider public.
It seems like something has happened, because now it's 2018 and the event yesterday was amazing. It was so wonderful to see both representatives from India and Pakistan being there, from Ghana, from Kenya, from Colombia, Uruguay, and 200 people attending. That is such a big contrast from like 4 years ago, 2014, when it took for me like 6 months to even get a meeting with UN Women. I wanted to share some of my initial results. But it seems like something has shifted and there is a greater interest now.
What do you think that change might have been? You know, is it the Me Too movement? Is it just the fact that, you know, you've yelled loud enough and people finally heard you? What do you think it might be?
Well, international relations, you have this whole tipping point theory where, you know, I feel like we've been trying to introduce a norm and then, yes, we've reached something. And sometimes you bring ideas and it's just not the right timing. And now, yes, there is something, you know, that says that you have to say it when you're just tired of saying something over and over again. This is when they start hearing us. And this is what happened.
So let me ask you now, you're talking about these women, you're talking about your own experiences. You know, what were the women like who you're talking about? I mean, were these sort of young, ambitious women who someone opened the door to? What do you know about them?
They're not so young. I mean, most of these women, the only women who could go to these international conferences and arenas were rather privileged economically and from a very strong social status background with a lot of support from their families. I would say that this was like well-educated, strong political women who had been doing a lot of work, so they were experts in their field. But I think that one of the reasons for their success was that they joined over national borders, they joined over religious borders, they joined over cultural borders, and they made coalitions and feminist alliances, and they really worked together, and I think that was the main strength. So they created a kind of a sisterhood, and I think that made some of the suggestions that they had, it was actually taken seriously because there were so many of them, and they came from different political and ideological backgrounds.
You had mentioned that they come from different backgrounds and that there were so many of them. Mm. How many women are we talking about? And can you tell me a little bit more about them?
Maybe to go back to the UN Charter, which Fatima and I have been focusing on. So there were 4 women signing the UN Charter, and it was overall 6 women that were appointed as full delegates, which is kind of the highest position you could have at the conference. So when we talk about all these many, many women, is that when we look in history, there are many women. There were few women in San Francisco. It was about 3% of the advisors and representatives there.
Yeah, yeah. It's the same with the declaration, that there were few women delegates in the national delegations. So, for example, the first instance that the declaration was debated in was the Human Rights Commission. There you had 2 female delegates. Mm-hmm. You had Eleanor Roosevelt from the United States, and you had Hansa Mehta from India.
And this is out of how many delegates?
18. So 2 were women. Then when I said many women coming together, that was the creation of the Commission on the Status of Women. Okay. So that was actually a commission with only women. There were about 19 or 20 names in the UN archives for different meetings for the Commission on the Status of Women. And they had 3 representatives on each meeting where the declaration was being debated for the meetings of the Commission on Human Rights. But the women representatives in the Commission on the Status of Women, they didn't have the right to vote on the different amendments to the declaration, but they could raise their voice and they could ask questions. How come divorce is not mentioned in this draft? Or how come the equality of men and women has not been repeated in the preamble, for example? The draft from the Commission on Human Rights was then forwarded to the third committee in the General Assembly, and there you had several more women delegates. So you had from 58 delegations, you had, I think it was 18 women. Mm-hmm. So then you had also Pakistan being represented. You had Poland being represented by a woman. You had the UK also being represented by women. So there you had several more women. Mm.
Maybe we can say a bit more what they did there, because I think looking at the numbers isn't necessarily very impressive. But what is really truly impressive is looking at the agencies that these particular women had and what they said there, because they did experience a lot of resistance and they had support. So we've been focusing on Berta Lutz. She was the Brazilian delegate. And it's really fascinating when we look at the memoirs and also her speeches in 1945. Like, you can see some of the things she says is that Article 8, which talks about gender parity in the UN system today, is a Latin American contribution to the constitution of the world. She said that at the conference, and she said it was written by Uruguay, and specifically also highlighted that it was women of these delegations who pushed for this article. So we're not only focusing on women because they are women, but it was actually these women, the Latin American women, that were leading the work on getting the language on gender.
I've done the same when I'm looking at the declaration. I only focused on the women who actually had a say in different meetings. So that's why I'm not also focused on the actual number. And
I wanted to ask you one more about something that you had mentioned, I think, Rebecca. You had talked about the fact that these were if I got it correctly, that these were women sort of from the global south. And the fact that maybe some of the resistance earlier on had come in from the fact that it was male historians from the west that were looking at all these documents. And you had also just mentioned this idea that, you know, these were women from sort of from the developing countries. Is it fair to say that it was really women from the global south who were much more visible at that time?
With the UN Charter, definitely. It was definitely Latin American women who were themselves actually qualifying themselves as coming from backward countries. And those are wordings that we don't even dare saying today. So they're the ones who identify themselves as, and they were very extremely vocal. They were saying that they were feminists. They were saying, but yes, it's completely true that yes, feminism, at least in the Charter, has been included by women from Latin America that were identifying themselves as coming from the developing countries.
So you very clearly see this being important for these women, this north-south divide. What we found was very fascinating that you had women from the north who said that there was no need for this spectacular feminism.
Really?
And they actually said to Bertha Lutz that she shouldn't ask for anything in the UN Charter because that would be a very vulgar thing to do. So there was a real push against also women's rights from women themselves,
but I can,
which is very fascinating.
Yeah, I would maybe frame it a little bit different. I would say that the women delegates from the UK and the United States, for example, they pushed back on a lot of the suggestions by the Southern women delegates. But that was more because they had another approach to feminism. They had another approach to women's rights. So they felt that having a commission with only women would be a segregating thing. Women should be included in the Commission on Human Rights. Or stating all the time men and women in the declaration, they felt was not needed because women were already included in the language men, all the men. So these were different approaches, and we have to take the historical context into consideration that in the United States at that point, there were a lot of discussions about equal rights amendment to the American Constitution. And there were a lot of women who felt that talking about equal rights of men and women would take away protective legislation for women that they have fought for a lot, like protection for women in factories, a protection for women if they got divorced, that they would be financially helped by their ex-husbands. And so there was a lot of legislation that they felt that maybe they would lose if they would push equality too much. So it's like two approaches, whereas the women delegates from India and Pakistan, and India and Pakistan, these women had joined together in the All India Women Conference before independence, before they became two countries. So, and there they had pushed together to explicitly write like women's rights. Like they knew that women would not be included if you would only say men. So they had another historical context where they joined.
It was the same with the Latin Americans. Yeah, they came from just having achieved women's right to vote. They were much more in the fight. They were coming straight from the battlefield, kind of. But while the more northern women from Norway, British and American, yeah, different, they kind of thought this battle had been won. You know, the general term, human rights of men, would be inclusive enough term.
Exactly. And also the women from India and Pakistan, you know, they had joined as freedom fighters with the nationalists. But then they saw that other interests would trump different battles.
That's fascinating. Do you see that any of those kind of old alliances still hold true among women groups from those countries? I mean, I know a lot of time has passed, but at least at the UN.
As we have been talking about this with a lot of Latin American delegations and with Brazil, it's quite inspiring because you hear them talking about how they work very closely together, that the Latin American delegations, and all member states say this, are very progressive, at least on some certain issues on women's rights. Colombia is leading the group of friends for women's, like it started to get for the group that would get the women selected for Secretary General. And now it's a big group that she is leading, the Colombian permanent permanent representative. So you see Latin American leadership on these issues today. You see some of those same alliances with the UN Charter, with the Universal Declaration.
But it's interesting also because now they're talking in the UN that like women's rights are human rights. But if we go back in history, when these two founding documents were being drafted, it was actually women from the South pushing that it would have to be human rights instead of the rights of man. When we talk about women's rights, there's been a new emphasis that women's rights are human rights. But yes, they are. We wouldn't have human rights without these women. And I think that's really fascinating.
That's true. But it's overall, when you start researching about the quotas in parliament, even women in politics and all, you might find surprising numbers in countries that you wouldn't expect would be so progressive. I mean, Rwanda, Latin America is still very like forerunners on the. And, you know, when you think, I mean, Latin America has a lot of women president, while some Nordic countries still haven't.
It's a complex picture, though. You know, there are very low representation of women in many parliaments, like being around 10% less in Brazil, for example. So that's obviously like a huge challenge. But you see still female leadership at the top. But it doesn't mean in Rwanda as well, you have a lot of representation of women in senior leadership. But does it really trickle down? Does it really mean that, you know, the more women workers, do they have the rights they need that are not, you know, in senior positions? And do they have equality with their husbands in terms of how they share different duties at home and right. these kind of things? So it's a very complex picture, talking about these alliances today.
We're running out of time, so I'd like to just allow each one of you to have a final word.
Just something that I want to raise that I was really inspired by through my research was the difference in like the initial work of the Commission on the Status of Women, that there was like an all-women commission and that women really cooperated regardless of religious background, regardless of nationality. And I think that was really inspiring, especially in contrast to today when you hear that at the Commission on the Status of Women there's a lot of discussions and conflicts in relation to like cultural values or religious values. And but so there I thought that, you know, going back in history could also create some kind of inspiration for maybe how the future could be with more, you know, cooperation beyond. Sometimes it's recreating conflicts that
man-made. Don't.
Yeah, exactly. Everything that is man-made can also be changed.
Yeah, I think it's like Rebecca's point is really what inspires me, that and I think Fatima as well, that we want to strengthen the ownership of gender equality, basically. Okay, history is important, and we definitely need more recognition of these women in history books and at the UN websites. And we need to, you know, easily Google Bertha Lutz and she would pop up at the UN website. That doesn't happen today. But overall, we really hope, like the event yesterday, we had 200 diplomats and UN staff attending, that this would kind of show that, you know, gender equality, women's rights, it's not kind of a particular phenomenon belonging to some part of the world. It is something that's everybody actually fights for. And you would see it throughout history. You have different women all over the world and men bringing up this issue, fighting for this issue to be, and women to be recognized in international documents and so on.
One of the things of doing it, and I think this is why we're also researching all this, is through role models. You know, as an Algerian, it's hard for me, for example, to be inspired by some Nordic feminist, or even when I was younger, Eleanor Roosevelt, because it's not the same. And then when you find out about how some Pakistani women, from India, Brazil, were so progressive on those issues, again, it goes back to ownership. And then you think, oh, wait, actually, it's not a Western thing. I remember when I was telling my family that, yeah, I'm a feminist. And they were like, no, that's not, it's not our issue. Let them. It's their thing. It's everyone's thing, you know. It's not a Western thing. It's everyone's. This is why, by putting some faces on this issue on gender equality, it kind of gives everyone, regardless background, origins, or education, it gives role models to a lot of women who might not have them yet.
Fatima Sator and fellow researchers Elise Dietrichson and Rebecca Adami are helping to uncover women's involvement in the establishment of the United Nations. And that brings us to the end of this episode of the UN Gender Focus podcast. I'm Paulina Greer. Thanks for joining us.